Our test for this morning is one that we often pop over, or just is part of the ongoing narrative as we go to find the teaching bits of the letter to the First Corinthians. It's one of the introductions, but it's also a central element, I think, to the rest of the book of 1 Corinthians. And in it, Paul is engaging this question of who is doing what and when. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 17 through 25. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom and elegance, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the philosopher of the age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know God. God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand a sign. Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Until it's winter. Try that we might. Sometimes we just come off a little bit foolish. And I'm happy to say that it didn't take me a great deal of time to wrap my brain for a case in point in my case. Like the occasion where I took a day trip by airplane from Manitoba to Saskatchewan to do some work in IT consulting. And that meant that I had to get up at an hour that I tried really, really hard to live with my eyes closed, if at all possible. And I got up and I got dressed and I got ready and I got out the door and I drove across town to the airport and I went through security. I got to the gate, which is the first time that they check your ID, and I forgot my wallet. Fortunately, I had my passport tucked inside my computer bag, so I was still able to travel, but I had to call up a colleague to say, could you meet me and pay for a cab and spot me a couple bucks so I could get through the day? Nothing quite ruins the facade of professional competence to show up and say, hi, my name is Bryce, and I'm a bonehead. We go to great lengths to hide the fact that this happens a lot. And we hide and equivocate and obfuscate and sometimes outright avoid situations. It merely on the fear that we might be seen as foolish. And sometimes it's exactly what we're doing that ends up making the whole thing come true anyways. We much prefer to be the cool, calm, collected, rationally working our way through the world but the most efficient way possible. The one who makes the least amount of waves, who gets on with life and world without much vulnerability, is the one who wins, by and large. We value our competence. We value making sense. We value being effective. We do this in our lives and we do this in our faith. But let's face it, faith in life demands of us not to make too terrible much rational sense in the world. Faith especially. Because when you think about it, there is a bunch of stuff that doesn't make a huge amount of sense. Loving one's enemies is not a terribly effective strategy for personal safety. We know way too many times that we're being an ethical, moral person is not the most profitable way to go. The list goes on and on. And we haven't even started with the actual rituals of doing church. Even last week, when we did communion, have you ever imagined what it would be like if you knew nothing of Christianity and you were sitting outside the window listening to the words of a communion service? This is my body broken for you. As often as you eat of it, remember me. Here's my blood spilt as a new covenant. Drink it and remember me. That goes beyond foolish. That starts suggesting that there might be a little bit of the daughter party at work here. We don't often think of it this way because our culture is basically has at least a conversant reality of Christian thought. At least it has. At the end of the day, it is a little bit weird. And we shouldn't be all that surprised that evangelism is hard. And frankly, it gets harder all the time. And that's where you usually turn to someone like me. Someone who is professionalized and rationalized and worked through the ways and means of faith in the church. I've studied, I've read, I've become a theologian. By which we mean someone who makes a study of something, to me it made sense, but rarely actually does so. Most of the time we end up talking in such language that we may not understand what we're saying at all. And it's good that we have a study and keep at it, but I always want to add a little footnote with anything that I say is, I think to the best of my ability, but when the Spirit is involved, who knows? Try that we might. The life of faith is a little bit of foolishness in our world and in our lives. So we try to make it make more sense. I already talked about the theological way, but we also construct these elaborate explanations of why it's there. If Christianity were a product, we would need a little bit of a rebranding to make it more saleable, and we do this all the time. The new, fresh, hip Christianity that's out there. We clean up Jesus, we clean up the way of discipleship, to make it less generally awkward to people and less demanding of us. And we try to make our good news of salvation from the way of life sound a little less like just a simple leap of faith. And we keep trying and trying and trying. But today I'm wondering whether in that trying we shouldn't just try something truly radical and try this starting with the bold truth. Yeah, it's foolish. It doesn't make sense. It's not always there, but it is good. It is true. It is what we are. When we try and hide the basic elements of our incredible faith, we rob it some of its power. The more we try to make sense of it, to explain the cross and why Jesus was upon it and how resurrection is even possible, we can just rob it of the mystery that is the power of the cross. And there's nothing wrong with that project, but at the end of the day, we have to always come back and simply say, this made sense simply because God is in it. And no other explanation will fully do. Because when we clean up Jesus too much, I think we lose some of what Paul is on about here. The power and the way and the will of the cross. That's what he's passionate about in writing back to Corinth. We're always painting Paul as the exemplary company man because more or less that's what we've made of him in the years since. We turn to Paul to set up the status quo and to defend it and to simply make things right. But I'm not always convinced that that's really what Paul is all about when you read Paul in the first place. First, he's always going for what is the response here that makes the most sense from the mission that I have it. He's a Jew among Jews and all the rest, but he keeps coming back and saying, you know what? If eating the wrong type of meat connects me to the people of God, so be it. But if eating meat at all stands in the way of the gospel of Christ, well, then I guess I'm a vegetarian. And on and on and on he goes. Paul is first and foremost a single-minded missionary, needing to achieve his aims and to adapt the gospel to the ways of the world, but never at the cost of simply acknowledging it for what it is. The impossible foolishness of Christ. When Paul left Corinth, he left a church where the message was, you are one body, all one person, all one social unit. And that was radical for the time, because if we think that we have social strata now, that's nothing on the Roman Empire. Corinth was a city that was as worldly and decadent as you can imagine. It was sat between two seaports, and the world is at its oyster. It was as cosmopolitan about its expectations of civilization as that would imply. And there's power and dissension and all the rest. So as you read through the book of Corinthians and say, well, I hear that you're doing this, you have to imagine that that's been the way it's been for quite some time. So, with all that said, when the Jesus movement takes root in Corinth, it's a big departure from what is. It's a whole shift of mindset from where you are to the virtue of God by grace alone. And after Paul's departure, it wasn't long before the sensibilities of the city began coming back into the body and making it harder and harder to do the radical sharing, the radical difference that Paul was talking about. The Christians in Corinth had begun committing immoral acts. They were suing each other and refusing to eat the Lord's Supper with each other. They were doing all the stuff that you would expect in the world. And the unity of the body was being threatened. And that's what this Paul to remind them of the kingdom of wisdom into which they were baptized. He begins to talk about this here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And he ultimately concludes this in his love chapter in chapter 13. Time and again, he commands them to think of others, to do something different, to do things that simply don't make sense in the real world. Over and over, he invites them into the foolishness which is the life of Christ. I submit that you cannot really read chapters 12 and 13, the ones that we keep coming back to time and again, without starting back here at chapter 1 and hearing, you know what? All this is through the foolishness and the reality of the cross of Christ. What's more is that the words here that he uses are quite telling. And as he's telling all of this, of this is foolishness to the outsider, Paul uses the word moria in Greek. Any guesses where moria gets used today? How about morons? Stupidity, idiocy. It's the same root. This is the stuff of morons, he's saying. And for the Hellenes, it was clear nonsense. Ultimate truth was not ever to be found in the physical world. They're the ones who gave us this hard and fast division between what's here and what's there. We're definitely down here, but the gods and all things good are out there, and never the twain shall meet. So, to come with it here, we're talking about the direct challenge to the construction of the universe. And then for the Jews, for centuries they've been told about what to expect of the Messiah and the forms of the righteous king and on and on and on. And Jesus of Nazareth was never any of these. And instead, by being crucified by the state, he becomes one cursed and has on him the curse of God according to the law of Moses. You can find that in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 23. To proclaim Christ crucified wasn't just bad taste, it was blasphemy. So all of this that we keep coming back to, we shouldn't be all that surprised that it sounds a little bit weird today. As our society becomes less and less churched, the fact of the matter is, people aren't going to have the basic understanding that of what this story is about, what it means, or whether it's even a good story. It's going to keep sounding more and more foolish because the way of God and the way of the cross is so laughable from those on the outside looking in. And time and again, we are invited to embrace the love of God and invited to embrace foolishness as we find it and where we find it. I come here basically because I think we need to remind ourselves of this now and again. It's a basic truth that we can forget. We want to make the way of God make sense, and perhaps we're trying too hard. Maybe we'd be better served to release the policies or practices of the world of how to get that stuff done, of how to be effective, of how to make sense in the world, and simply say, yeah, All that is good, all that is there, but this, what we're doing here, the body of Christ, it's not necessarily going to look that way. It's not necessarily going to work that way. And moreover, our world is not necessarily run that way alone. We're invited to the way in the cross of Christ that holds no person beyond the pale, no situation is beyond hope, and no reality is beyond the redemption of God. And we do well to embrace all that we do and why we do it, not necessarily because it's supposed to be an efficient model of how to run a corporation or a world or a church, but rather simply because this is the faithful way of following Christ. And as for what happens in the headlines, maybe we can just remind ourselves, regardless of the season, that the foolishness of the cross is where true power lies and will always lie. And when God is involved, all bets, all plans, all systems come to naught. And that is good. The good news is this, that God's way is not the way of the world, regardless of the season. That God's way of love and compassion will rule at the end of the day. This is the only truth that matters, and the only hope that is of substance, no matter where we find ourselves. It's often said in the higher churches that the work of worship is to every week simply proclaim Christ is arisen and to find a way in response to say he has arisen indeed and to be changed by that confession week in, week out, season in, season out. If our basic work is to attest to the risenness of Christ, we are invited to the foolishness of Christ time and again. From that basic proclamation, a whole myriad of ideas and implementation has come to the fore. And we're invited to foolishly embrace it. Embrace it fully and live it as completely as we try our best each and every day to find our voice and declare the Lord has risen indeed. That's our hope. That's our way. That's our work. May we ever be foolish. Amen.